In 1886, Cyrus Adler had just arrived as a doctoral student in Assyriology at the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. That fall, the young Semitics scholar was researching in a private library when he stumbled upon a most curious find. Tucked into the shelves of the library were two copies of an 1804 imprint of the King James Version of the New Testament of the Bible. But it was the note attached to those two volumes which quickly got his attention. The note stated that these were two of the volumes that Thomas Jefferson had used to create the book which he called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. Adler quickly began to leaf through these volumes, finding indeed that certain sections of the Gospels had indeed been very neatly excised, removed, slipped from their moorings. Thrilled with this discovery, Adler attempted to now locate a copy of this remarkable book, The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. His search proved to be fruitless, however, and so he returned to his studies, earning his doctorate and then teaching Semitics there at Johns Hopkins for several years. In addition to his teaching, however, Adler also began to serve, and I love the titles that existed in the late 19th century. He was honorary assistant curator of Semitics at the United States National Museum of the Smithsonian Institution. And after several years serving in this illustrious post, Adler was named curator of historic archaeology and historic religions at the United States National Museum. It was from this post that he resumed his quixotic search for those slices of the New Testament which Thomas Jefferson had so carefully removed from his copies of the New Testament by way of his very sharp razor. Well, as our story would have it, Adler's search found its end in 1895, when, as curator of historic religions for the Smithsonian, he was able to purchase The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth from Thomas Jefferson's great-granddaughter, Carolina Randolph, for the princely sum of $400. And so it was later, that same year, that The Life and Morals was first exhibited, now with the better-known title of The Jefferson Bible. Now, the Jefferson Bible was one of Thomas Jefferson's chief passions later in life and one of his more private endeavors. Jefferson, truly a disciple of the Enlightenment, was attempting to distill the teachings of Jesus to their essence, teachings which Jefferson continued to believe that they were the most sublime and benevolent code of morals which has ever been offered to man. So, from those New Testament volumes that Cyrus Adler was to stumble upon some 80 years later, Jefferson constructed the life of Christ, rationally, logically, and chronologically even. So the first verse of the first page of the Jefferson Bible reads as follows. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. From Luke's introduction of Jesus' birth narrative, Jefferson then ventures to Matthew's gospel, then over to Mark's gospel, and eventually to John's account of Jesus' life. All right, Sunday morning quiz time. What is missing from this introduction to Jesus' birth? Well, that would be angelic visits to Zechariah and then to Mary. That's what should begin Luke's gospel, but Jefferson didn't account for this in Jesus' life. Nor did he include the genealogy from Matthew's gospel or the magnificent metaphysical poetry of John's prologue. And this pattern continues throughout Jefferson's Bible as he left behind any allusion to the supernatural. Gone are any references to miracle or resurrection, divine revelation or incarnation. All that Jefferson took were the sayings, the teachings of Jesus, along with the bare bones of his life. So it should not be a surprise that this, the sixth chapter of John's Gospel, remained safely in those volumes that the young Cyrus Adler uncovered. For Thomas Jefferson, like many followers of the Enlightenment, had little use for today's passage with its miracles of feeding thousands and walking upon the sea. They had broken free of the superstitions of the Middle Ages, bringing the razor of rational thought to bear upon all of what was known, Holy Scripture being one of them. Now, I'll admit, my science courses at Cal were not the highlight of my stay here several years ago. But I do remember something about matter not being able to be created nor destroyed. And so, as for our case in point, I find it, well, incredible that from 5 loaves and 2 fish, Jesus created enough loaves and fish to feed 5,000 people. Or that he was able to walk on the sea as if it were dry land. And yet, I find that Jefferson and many others throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater when they simply excise these passages of the text as being pre-modern hocus-pocus. Because these passages, for those who heard them and for those who hear them now, are not solely told to be a proof of the divinity of Christ. No, they serve as signs. Signs that point to a truth, a reality about the Creator and the created. This particular sign is a story about bread, but like all the signs in John's Gospel, it isn't about bread alone. It's not so much about what happened on this mountain as it is about what came from it. Much like the miracle of the wine in John's second chapter in Cana of Galilee, also not found in Jefferson's Bible, because that miracle isn't about wine alone. And for heaven's sake, no matter what you hear, when someone offers to give you a defense of marriage, this miracle wasn't about a wedding either. Actually, all of these actions are signs, guideposts to who Jesus is. They are pointers offered to us by those who were close to him, pointing to what he is about, from whence he comes. Rather than being a tonic against doubt, they are meant to give us a glimpse of the source of all that is. Setting aside for the moment how these loaves of bread and scores of fish came to be enough, just wonder a moment with me. What if it were really true that this world and all that is in it was created not as insufficient or to be just enough, but what if it were true that the creation in its total was created to be more than enough? That is, in effect, that it is abundant. What if it were true that we didn't need to hoard out of the fear that there would not be enough for us? What if it were true that we really could have what was necessary, and that when all had received what they needed, there really would be much left over? And what if, in the midst of the storms, when the seas have grown rough and the wind is strong and battering us, what if, at that moment, we were able to know the presence of the one who created us? What if, when we had received that awful diagnosis, or are walking out of that office holding a pink slip? What if, alongside, in the midst of the storm, we glimpsed stillness itself. While the waves are crashing and our fear is rising, the one who is Easter says, I am here. Be not afraid. What if? Friends, in these stories, just as in the stories of our lives, it is often true that the presenting need we face is physical. People want wine for celebration. They need water for thirst, bread for hunger. But all of these physical needs point to a deeper need, one that we all yearn to know, the deep desire for communion. Communion in all its forms, with another person, with the creation, through the generations, around this table. All of these ultimately lead back to the source of abundance, the source of real presence. A couple of years ago, I was part of a group of young adults from this parish who went to spend several days at a Franciscan worker community in Salinas. We spent our days cleaning and cooking and serving food in a homeless shelter on the other side of the tracks from downtown Salinas. At night, sleeping on the floors and couches of the community. One of those nights, the founder spoke with us about the origins of that community that has served the last, the lost, and the least in Salinas for 3 decades. It began on a shoestring like many do, and within a few months of making sandwiches and handing these sandwiches out to the hungry on Soledad Street, they had exhausted their meager finances. And so they held their last meeting. As always, it started with prayer. They gave thanks for what had been given. And they asked for help one last time. Again, I can't speak to method, but a large delivery truck did pull up to the house at that moment, and it had day-old bread in it. The driver had heard about this group and wanted to give to their effort. Those who gathered that day were ecstatic. Not lost on them, of course, was the reality of the many, at least hundreds, who would be fed by this gift of bread. Not 20 minutes went by when a second delivery truck arrived in the front of the community's modest house. And the story goes that this truck came bearing cans of tuna, fish. When reading these texts, do we expect loaves and fishes to materialize out of thin air? Or Nazarenes to walk on water? Maybe not. But we must not lose sight of these signs which point us to what is true. Because there is abundance if we but see it. And there is presence if we are but aware of it. But friends, it is when we remove that space to wonder that we are no longer able to participate in what is extraordinary.